Judiciary Committee is in order. We have a quorum present, that being Senators Miller, Parnell, Chair Taylor. First matter up before the committee is Senate Bill 254. The sponsor was the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Are you going to present for them? Give us your full name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Pauley. I'm a staff aide to Senator Lehman, Chairman of the Labor and Commerce Committee. Senate Bill 254 is, as you noted, a committee bill, and I'll make just a few brief comments on the legislation's intent. Senate Bill 254 will significantly enhance the ability of Alaskan businesses and other private parties to collect from debtors who are in a state of default on their financial obligations. Existing state law provides that 45% of a person's annual permanent fund dividend check is exempt from collection to pay an outstanding debt. In other words, even though a person may have a court judgment stipulating that they owe a certain amount of money, almost half of their dividend check is exempt from collection, at least when it's a private party that's seeking to collect. There are some exceptions to this rule. Child support obligations, defaulted student loans, and any other debt that's owed to the state is a different matter, and the state is entitled in those circumstances to collect 100% of that dividend. Small businesses and other private parties do not enjoy that same right. When businesses are not able to collect funds from those in default, it increases the cost of doing business, and ironically, those costs are passed on to honest consumers in the form of higher costs for goods and services. So in a very real sense, the majority of Alaskan consumers are paying for the financial irresponsibility of a small minority. As originally introduced, Senate Bill 254 proposed to completely eliminate the 45% exemption. However, an amendment adopted in committee restored the exemption but lowered it from 45% to 30%. This means that the percentage of the dividend available for garnishment by private parties would increase from 55% to 70%. State agencies, however, would continue to collect at the rate of 100%. In addition to this change, the Labor and Commerce Committee added a fee for garnishing dividend checks. The fee is equal to 5% of the value of the check, and the money is taken from the defaulter's dividend check and deposited into the general fund. Currently, the Permanent Fund Division charges only $2 for each garnishment that they process. The 5% fee applies across the board, both to private parties and to state agencies who are garnishing the check. As currently structured, Senate Bill 254 will significantly narrow the gap between what private parties and the state are able to collect. That concludes my prepared comments, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions committee members may have.
Now, the original purpose of the bill was to shift it to 70% only?
No. As the bill was originally introduced, it completely eliminated the exemption. So, in other words, private parties would have 100% of a check available for garnishment, just as state agencies currently do. There was an amendment that was introduced in Labor and Commerce Committee to restore the exemption, but to lower it from the current rate of 45% to a rate of 30%. And that amendment was approved in committee on a 3-1 vote, and is now part of this committee substitute.
Can you tell me why we should treat citizens differently from the way we treat the state? Senator Miller?
Mr. Chairman, that discussion went on at length in Labor and Commerce, and the concern of the committee at that particular point in time was that if you garnish 100%, what incentives is there for anyone to ever file one of these forms out?
Well, the same would apply on estate debt or child support, wouldn't it?
It would, although in some cases there may be, I don't know if there's court orders that you have to fill it out, although I know some lending agencies are talking about making it a part of a contract to, if you go get a loan, that you are under contractual obligation to fill out for your permanent fund should you default. But they could, it was a real concern of the committee at the time that if there's no incentive for anybody to fill this form out, you know, collecting 70% of something is collecting 100, is better than collecting 100% of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other concern was the $2 fee. The other Labor and Commerce thought it was ridiculously low, only be collecting $2 per garnishment.
But do we have someone here from the department?
Yeah. And so that's why we increased it to 5%.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Miller. Appreciate that. I don't have any further questions.
Thank you.
find next on this. I don't have a sign-up sheet here in front of me, so maybe whoever's... Deborah, come right in.
Senator, I'm Deborah Vogt, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Revenue, and I came today because the department includes, of course, both the Permanent Fund Dividend Division and the Child Support Enforcement Division, and so we see sort of both ends of these transactions. Garnished dividends are, in fact, a very significant chunk of the, sometimes the only money that we collect from some obligors. And we have previously said that from the division's perspective, we don't oppose the change in from 100% down, or from 45% down to 30% in the amount that's protected. And in fact, it doesn't have any program implications if you took it all the way to zero. There is the concern, which we have seen in the Child Support Agency, that people do not apply, and with Child Support, just as Senator Miller was referring to, you can order a person either in a court order or although Child Support hasn't used this technique, but they could order a party to apply for the dividend. But we have identified a fairly significant number of people that simply don't apply, even though they owe the money. The reason I came today was to speak to the 5% fee. And I guess I question the public policy of reducing the amount available to private parties and to state agencies by 5%. We have, as the sponsor testified, in the past charged $2 per transaction as a fee, which has resulted in a program receipts appropriation to the department of about $150,000. This legislation, as our fiscal note shows, would generate about $3.5 million. And if you assume that the Department of Revenue is on one end of every transaction, that sort of implies that there's an equal amount split between the court and student loan and CSED and private parties who are on the other end of all the rest of the transactions. I think that $3.5 million is grossly disproportionate to the amount that can legitimately be said to represent administrative costs. And I think that the impact on creditors is significant. The sponsor's statement represented that government agencies will continue to get 100%. Not so. They'll get 95% under this legislation. Full 5% will be deposited in the general fund. And it's basically taking money out of the hands of private individuals, whether they be creditors or debtors. All the debtors are private individuals, and putting it in the general fund. And I just question the public policy in doing that. That's all I had to say. Nancy can testify to the program effects. So if you have any questions on that,
any questions? Senator Miller?
Well, in the discussion in the committee, the argument that was advanced forward versus the 5% versus the $2, first of all, $2 is incredibly low. I would venture to say $2 does not cover the cost of collection. But say I, as a private individual, took something to a collection agency, you know, that collection agency is going to charge me a fee in order to collect that debt. That's going to be much greater than 5%. So, I don't see a problem with, I don't have a problem with the 5%, I really don't, because if you took that same debt to a private agency, it's going to cost you a whole lot more. So I just don't really see a problem with that.
Mm-hmm. Part of my concern, of course, is that many of these debts have been taken to a private agency, and they now are attempting to collect them, and they're going to lose 5% too. So where you were giving up 50% to get a collection agency to go after them, now you're going to lose 55% of that resource available to be applied against the loan. I, too, believe 2 is probably low, but I think there's probably public policy for why we ought to keep it low. I mean, the amount of work that the department actually does is pretty insignificant compared to the amount of work the individual has to do to get it there. They just file a lien, literally.
Senator It really is fairly insignificant. We run them mostly by computer matches with loans from the requesting agencies, child support or student loan or the court system. And the court system has been problematic because their computer runs haven't been quite as good as some of the other agencies, but they're catching up. I'm really connected to making it easier, and eventually it'll the you know, we do have a couple of postage costs. We mail people, two different notices on every garnishment, whether even if an individual's garnished three times, they'll get two different notices on each garnishment. And we have a lot of phone calls about the garnishment. But other than that, the administrative costs really are not very high.
5 is 60. Yes, Senator Parnell.
So what do you figure it costs to do this each year, roughly, just this function of, you know, processing?
We believe that the $150,000 that we get in program receipts is adequately compensated.
So the $2 charge gets you $150,000, and that currently pays for the program.
Just about. In fact, I mean, were we to go to 5% and the 5% collects $3.5 million, we'd still continue to request program receipts of $150,000.
So in addition, we're getting, with the legislation, we're still getting that. I mean, currently we're getting $150,000 plus. If the legislation went without the 5%, we'd still see revenues of $3.4 million additional dollars coming in. I mean, the revenues from the fiscal note, is that what?
No. The $3.5 million is the 5%. I mean, that's what.
Oh, I see. You're right. Okay.
Generates.
Okay. But you're saying currently the $2 covers the cost of
the division processing claim.
And I might mention one other potential problem that we don't really know whether it's a problem or not, but the IRS was not very happy about our $2 fee, and they have acquiesced in it because it's $40,000 total for them in return for collecting an awful lot of revenue. But their position is that we're not entitled to take anything, and certainly taking $65 instead of $2 is going to push their willingness to accede in our collecting fee at all.
There's another thing, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. In the way the bill reads currently, it states that each claim would be 5%. So there are multiple claims. We get over 80,000 requests for claims against dividends. It amounts to about 50,000 actual people. So the bill is not specific on whether there's a cap of 5% or whether it's 5% each, meaning that a person gets, you know, three times $65 if it's three claims. And in the committee, there was a discussion, and informally they thought that they intended to have a cap on it, but it doesn't show in the bill.
Yes, Senator Parnell.
If all we wanted to do was to change from 45% to 30% and leave the administrative fee the same as $2. To do that, to accomplish that, would we just have to get rid of sections 2 and 3 in the CS for the Senate bill?
Sure.
Would that do it?
I think that's right, Senator.
Thank you. You need to give the Secretary your name, too.
Nancy Jones, Director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division.
Thank you. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else wish to testify on this bill? We have online Steve Phillips in Ketchikan. Mr. Phillips?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
My name is Steve Phillips. I own Ketchikan Credit Bureau here in Ketchikan. A couple of the things that have bothered us about the bill from the start was we were in support of the 100% to a point other than exactly what we were just discussing here as far as people failing to file at all if there was no benefit to them. But the way the bill is wrote right now, we're not sure where the 5% is coming if the 5% stays in. It shows that there's 30% exempt, but in the summary that came out of the labor, it says the money would come out of the debtor's side which he actually then no longer would have 30%, they would have 25%. That needs to be clarified, I think, before it goes any farther.
Yeah, I can't tell you that. Where are you reading that?
It's in basically a summary that came from Central Lehman's office showing what it was. And it basically, well, it doesn't basically. It says the amendment was offered to restore the PERM fund exemption, but to lower it from 45 to 30%. In other words, 70% could be garnished. And then it goes on to say that the 2% or the $2 that's now being taken would go to 5% that would come from the debtors part of his exemption. And if you pull another 5%, you've lowered them to 25%. And I don't know how you're going to rectify that with the court system when the debtor goes in and says, I have 30% exempt, but you pull another 5%.
Yeah, could you explain that? Steve, I think Deborah Vogt may be able to explain that.
The legislation, Senator, sections 2 and 3, both provisions provide that the money comes from, if a small portion of the dividend is claimed, then the money will come out of the debtor's dividend before the assignment. But if the entire dividend is claimed, then the 5% comes out of the money that would otherwise go to the creditor. In other words, it comes out of the dividend. If there's enough to pay both the 5% to the general fund and the, say, 20% of it that is owed to child support, then 20% goes to child support and 5% goes to the general fund. If child support is owed 100%, then 95% will go to child support and 5% to the general fund. Could I make that more confusing or clear?
Well, the question he's asking, I think, is if there's $500 that's owed and the dividend is at $1,300 or $1,400, and the debtor is supposed to be paying the $500 to some creditor that this man's representing, then they put in a levy for the $500, and as long as it does not exceed 70%, I guess it would be, under here, then they would get paid. Would the remainder, the 5% administrative fee, come out of the amount going to the creditor, come out of the amount being received by the debtor on his exemption?
The way I read it in the case, Senator, of one of the levies by a party other than a government agency that would be limited to 70%, the way I read the legislation is that the 5% comes out of the remaining 30%, so that in a sense 25% is protected from levy, 70% can go to the creditor, and 5% will go for the fee. On the other
hand, his interpretation was correct then.
It won't reduce his amount if he's collecting private debts. It will reduce the amount available to the state agencies.
And it'll also reduce the amount that is exempted and going to be conveyed to the debtor.
Right. The debtor will... Exactly. The debtor.
Apparently your understanding of that is correct, Mr. Phillips.
Mr. Taylor, we're back to the same issue, though, is that if we take this in, if we garnish 100% of what's available to us, which is 70%, we go into the court, and you're sitting in front of a judge, and he looks at the statute that says that the debtor is entitled to 30% non-exempt. I mean, that's exempt money. 70 is not. We take that extra 5% to the state for general funds. The debtor no longer is entitled to the 30%, and the court's going to say, wait a second, you're going to give the money back, or the state is. Obviously, the state's not going to give it back.
Yeah, I understand the question you raised. I think we may be wiser to just go back to the $2 fee. That $2 fee, however, does it also run afoul of the same problem on the percentile of exempt? If you have a debt that's owed that's $2,000, and you're only going to get 70%, and you convey, then does the $2 come out of the exempt
person? It comes out of the remaining exempt portion.
Right.
It's taken Yeah, it comes out of the of the dividend applicant's part. Of,
right, right. And I think the same argument might still be available, but the amounts become so de minimis it might not have,
right.
Have anybody willing to champion it very far. What are you doing for your $2 with child support or state loans where 100% is being taken?
They pay the 2%. I mean, they pay the $2.
Okay, so the $2 then comes out of
out
the
of,
amount that would have gone to child support.
Right, it comes out of the dividend that is being attached. And so if the dividend's $1,300, then $1,298 goes to CSCD. And
I see. You take your two off the top before
right.
you send it to them. Okay. Is that a significant number of folks that that actually have their full dividend check taken?
I think as far as child support is concerned, most of them, most of the dividends are, most of the assessments are for the full amount. There's a number there.
I mean, I can't see why anyone who owes a debt, even knowing full well that that money's going to be taken, wouldn't still go ahead and apply for your dividend. That's having the people of the state of Alaska pay off $1,400 a year debt next year.
It certainly makes sense, Senator, but we do know that there are some who don't, and you're dealing, of course, with the most emotional parts of people's lives that are
sure, I understand.
Involved and so on, and sometimes they just don't want to. And the way that we know that there are those who don't apply is because we track down on a case-by-case basis a number of applicants who applied for dividends were garnished by CSCD, and then CSCD ended up not getting paid. And we explored the reasons why those applicants were not paid. And largely, they had some further action that they needed to take to sort of perfect their application, and they didn't take it. So they were they had the incentive to apply in the first place, but they didn't have a lot of incentive to answer letters and further requests for information and clarify.
But in those instances, especially under child support enforcement, the court could have, by motion of the department, signed basically the application for them or forced them to do so, couldn't it?
Senator, we still need to determine whether the person still lives in Alaska, was in the state for the appropriate length of time. You know, there still are reasons that a person might be ineligible other than the fact that he didn't apply.
I'm just trying to get back to the same point. I think if we're going to treat state agencies and state loan programs one way, we ought to treat the rest of the public the same way if we can. And if, in fact, there's a whole lot of people out there that are going to refuse to go get found money
mm-hmm.
so that they can make certain that their debts are paid, I would think that has to be a very small percentage of folks that would do that.
And I don't know exactly how large it is. I know that there are some, is all I know, because I have seen the specific files of folks that apply.
You don't have a percentile or anything?
Of the department? Of the people who are garnished by CSCD that we think are Alaskans that don't apply?
No, we don't have any statistics on who does not apply.
But at best, it's a very small number, isn't it?
We would imagine the only way that we can sort of infer that there's a difference in the population and the number of applications we receive. Last year, the population was over 600,000, and we received 575,000 applications. But, you know, in there, people die, people leave the state for other reasons, so it's kind of a mess. You can't really say that that's the people who don't file, but there is a difference, and that's the only kind of basis that we have, since we can't track you if you don't file.
Okay. I didn't have any other questions for you, Sean. Mike. Anything further, Steve?
Senator Taylor, Mr. Pauley had touched on it earlier a little bit. We would like to see this actually go to 75% that is non-exempt, that is attachable by the creditors. Three-quarters is a good number to work with as far as we're concerned. The other issue is that a number of years ago, we introduced very similar legislation, and it came back to the point is that there was a center that's no longer there that said that we were hurting the people that couldn't afford, basically, to pay this. the bottom line is that there's less than 5% that we deal with that are debtors. Now, you know as well as I do, in private practice or in a store or whatever, we're the other 95% are paying for that 5%. In other words, if it's Ben Williams at Alaskan and Proud, either in Juneau or Ketchikan, Haines, Sitka, wherever, he still has to make enough money to open the door. So if that 5% that he's losing to these people, you and I and the rest of pay our bills are the ones that are now paying for that 5%. So this is an avenue that we have to reach back and get the money back for Mr. Williams or other creditors that are out there, so we're not hurting the other 95%. So that's something we've always got to keep in mind, that these 5%, nobody twisted their arms to write that bad check or not to pay their debt.
Yeah, I guess you. Well, thank you very much, Steve. We've got some people up in Anchorage also on 254. It looks like Ty Sorensen. Who's Tam? With Johnson Nissan Jeep, are you on?
Yes, it's Tori Sorensen.
Tori, go right ahead.
And yes, I work for Johnson Nissan Jeep Eagle, and basically my concern about getting 100% of the dividend is the fact that governmental agencies have priority over local businesses here in the state of collecting a debt, and you think it would be a fair assumption to assume that we should all be having equal rights to attempt to get that debt, and, you know, get it paid and collected through the permanent fund dividend, if that's our last resort. And I know for the place that I work for now, just implementing this year, we attached 18% interest on people who don't pay on their promissory notes, whereas before we did not, and that's a hefty amount. And it just really does hurt the honest guy out there paying for it, even if he's a little late or what have you, that 18% interest, because we aren't able to collect it either fast enough or get a high enough amount on the permanent fund dividend. And sometimes, you know, we do have problems, like I heard you discussing, of people not filling out an application to pay for the debt. And, you know, I have no, you know, ideas on how to go about, you know, fixing that or what have you, but I just want to say that I think it would be a good idea to be able to get the 100% of the dividend attached.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Ken Jacobus on 254.
Thank you. Just a few brief comments. I'm talking from the point of view of an attorney who sees this from time to time during the course of my practice and then everybody else's practice. A lot of Alaskans do business in cash, hide assets, et cetera, make it very difficult to collect judgments against them. Many times the permanent fund dividend is the only asset of a debtor that can be located. The people that are really hurt here are the unsophisticated individuals who have just claims. They go to small claims court and get judgments. These individual Alaskans need to have a source from which to collect these debts, one which is identifiable and can be located. I personally believe that you should return to the 100% as it was originally. I believe that more money will be generated in total to pay debts, even though a few people may not apply for their dividends. I think most people will apply for it anyway. Would recommend that you go back to 100%. The more money that's made available to collect adjusted debts, the better off Alaskans are. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this legislation? Senator Parnell, did you have an amendment?
No, Mr. Chairman, but I do have a... I have a conflict of interest and need to disclose that, as in my law practice, I do collection work, we attach dividends, and both my creditors and perhaps me could benefit from this legislation, so I would ask I be allowed to abstain from voting on the bill or any amendment.
I'll object.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Miller.
I guess I would... I feel very strongly about leaving the 70% in there. However, listening to the arguments on the $2, I'm willing to go with the agency on the $2. However, I'd be very upset if they come back in a couple of years and say they don't have enough money to do the collections part of it. So I guess with that, to get back to the $2, I think we just have to strike Section 2 and 3.
Motion is to eliminate Sections 2 and 3 from the bill. Further discussion? Is there any objection? There being no objection, the motion passes. I don't do any collection work in my business.
You're lucky, man.
I did put the bill in, I think, a couple of years ago to go back to 100, and I would like to treat it that way, but I understand your concerns, Arne. And at least we've given them another 15% of it, I guess, in this process. Maybe over time we'll whittle it right down to the place where citizens will be treated the same as our state agencies. Agencies don't seem to feel it's a real problem on providing them with incentives, or they'd be in here saying giving 15-20% too, I think. But I'm willing to leave it, I guess, if you are. Senator Pierce, any comments? Senator Parnell, anything further? Pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I'd move 254 out of committee with individual recommendations as amended by the chair.
There being an objection to the motion to move as amended. Being no objection, bill moves. SB 195, common law liens. Again, Labor and Commerce Committee. You guys have been busy down there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Tim Benintendi. I'm staff assistant to Senator Tim Kelly. And we have Senate Bill 195 before you today, which is designed to address the emerging problem of the filing of nuisance liens as a form of retribution. Such liens have been filed against property owned by public officials and others who have fallen into disfavor with certain groups and individuals who embrace opposing philosophical or political views. The liens rarely, if ever, have true commercial foundation, but rather are used as a harassment tactic. The practice now has surfaced in Alaska, as several officials at the municipality of Anchorage can attest. SB 195 would make a misdemeanor out of recording a non-consensual common law lien without a court approval. It would ease the process of releasing the lien and would provide for filing a notice of invalid lien by attorneys for those public officials. This bill would set out civil penalties against those who would file such liens as well. The bill carries 2-0 fiscal notes and a wide variety of public support. And we do have testimony today from the testimony available from the Alaska court system, if you desire. And with that, I'll see if you have any questions.
Can you just tell us generically what a common law lien is?
It's basically a filing against property on behalf of an individual who feels he has an action against an individual. And beyond that, I don't know a lot of the technical ramifications.
Senator Brown?
Can we get the court system?
Sure. Thank you very much, Tim.
Sure.
On behalf of the court system?
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. And the court system had asked that this bill be introduced to address, as Mr. Benintendi mentioned, a growing problem in Alaska. And common law liens, this type of common law lien, unlike all other sorts of liens against real property, has no connection to the property itself. Normally, if you file a lien, record a lien against somebody's property, like a mechanic's lien or materialman's lien, you have furnished goods or services for the benefit of that property. Like you work on somebody's roof, they don't pay you, you can record a lien against that particular building for the value of your services. You can't, however, record a lien against that house if that person didn't pay their grocery bill. There has to be a connection between the debt and the property. What these common law liens do is the person will believe they have some type of claim against you. And the examples that I provided in your backup with the suits in Anchorage, there was a zoning enforcement action. Somebody who ran afoul of the Anchorage zoning laws. There's a complaint filed. So in retribution for the zoning enforcement action that followed, the person filed recorded liens against Mayor Rick Maestrom, all the members of the Municipal Assembly, the zoning enforcement officers that were involved in the case, as well as the neighbor who had initially complained about the zoning violation. There's no connection between the property that was liened and the violations. And the violations, you could have conceivably legitimate complaints against somebody. This person alleges racial discrimination, harassment, and all types of other things that would conceivably constitute a cause of action in court. But there's, in fact, in this case, it didn't. But the liens are recorded as a form of retribution, as mentioned, as retaliation against them. As a matter of fact, there was a separate lien filed in a case after the one against the mayor and the members of the assembly, another zoning enforcement case where they recorded liens against all the property of the zoning enforcement officers again. In that case, it says right in the lien, this is in retaliation for the zoning enforcement action. And it's these types of liens that SB 195 is aimed at. There are lots of ways to legitimately record liens against property without ever going to court. As I mentioned, mechanics liens, materialmen's liens, lumberman liens, lots of liens set out in statute where if you have provided some sort of goods or services to somebody, they haven't paid you in at all or in part, you then have a claim against that property that you have benefited. And this bill has been narrowly drafted not to affect any of the existing statutory liens, but is aimed at the non-consensual common law liens that were the source of the problems in Anchorage. They've also had liens recorded against a couple of state troopers. They've been threatened against a lot of CSCD employees. Been threatened against, although I don't believe any of them actually been recorded against several judicial officers, clerks of court, just a whole variety of people. There's a magistrate in Anne Moran in Kodiak who's had, well, she has $1 million judgment against her too in a common law court, which of course is non-existent, but they get a judgment against her for acting as a magistrate, and they've threatened to record liens against her property. Although she just sold the house and bought another one, so she doesn't think they're ever recorded. But they are threatened as often as they're used.
Yes, Senator Parnell.
Are common law liens, I mean, are there categories of them that you could name that have appeared throughout the years? I mean, what are they styled as when the recorder's office gets them? Does it just say common law lien and then describes it, or do they have specific categories of common law liens?
Well, no, the only legitimate common law lien that I've been able to track down, which is, a lien when you do have a claim against it, again, it has to be tied to property. It's not like other types of, contractual disputes. There was a case many years ago in Alaska where a real estate agent, you may have seen this case, a real estate agent was listed as the sole listing agent for the sale of a house or a building of some sort. And she alleged that agreement was violated. The person sold the house without her input, and she recorded a lien on the property for the services, for her listing services. Now, she ended up losing in court on that claim, but that would be an example. And
isn't that the same thing as a list pendant?
Well, it's
statutory.
It may have been more properly filed as a list pendant, but she had it recorded as a lien.
Okay.
In court.
Will this affect Liz Pendens' liens?
No, it won't. The Liz Pendens court is a separate entity in itself. It's a notice that that property is in dispute, title to property or right of possession of property is currently being litigated. These liens, they may look like a regular lien, but they aren't. There's no tie, and they aren't alleging that the title is in dispute, which is currently a felony, a false filing, but because the title isn't in dispute. But this
well,
is...
You're still allowing, even in this legislation, common law property liens to occur, but only if there's been
right.
consent by the owner.
Right.
Or
judge. Right.
Excuse me.
Yeah,
the maximum potential penalty?
Class A misdemeanor.
Which is translated for us lay people?
$5,000.
A year in jail.
Any further questions? I didn't have anybody signed up on the sheets here to testify on the teleconference. Was there anyone else in the room that wished to offer testimony on SJR 195? Pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Cornell.
I'd move SB 195 from committee's individual recommendation.
Is there any objection to that motion? There being no objection, the bill moves from committee. Senate Joint Resolution Number 35. Senator Miller, you have staff that's going to...
Mr. Chairman, I will just briefly give it a little bit, and I know we have a number of people on teleconference who would like to testify. Senate Joint Resolution Number 35 comes out of the Supreme Court decision of November 21st of last year, which basically struck down a section of a 1970 statute, Section 18.16.010B in the statute at that particular time, which basically said that any quasi public organization or hospitals or individuals essentially, in my view, have to participate in an abortion, even if their beliefs or whatever would dictate differently. And going back and doing a little bit of history upon this, and if you go back to the 1970 House Journals, it was then Representative Barry Jackson, who is from Fairbanks, who was the chairman, who, by the way, is an abortion rights advocate. He, in the journal, said that he stated on the floor at that time that the bill provided that a hospital or person is not required to participate in an abortion, and neither a hospital or person be held liable for refusing to participate in abortion. And this section was added to make sure that abortion is truly a personal decision upon those individuals, all the parties to the abortion, and to ensure that no one was, that no coercion may be applied to anyone. And essentially, this would restore that delicate balance that was set out in the 1970 law by instituting in the right to privacy clause that nothing in the Constitution requires a hospital or person to participate in an abortion, which I think is the proper thing to do, because as people who believe that an abortion is a personal or is a right or is an issue of choice, then I would also counter that it's also a choice for a person to not participate. Choice goes both ways. I guess it's a little rather ironic from my particular point of view that the whole thing was put into that the state Supreme Court has regarded the right to privacy clause of our Constitution as a right to an abortion. It's ironic in the fact that my older brother, who was in the legislature at that time, was the primary author of that right to privacy clause, and I had many discussions that I had with him over the years about that issue. It really had nothing to do with the abortion issue, although the courts have later inferred it to have something to do with the abortion issue. So I guess it was a little bit ironic on my point, my particular view, that that the court drew that connection out of it. But with that, Mr. Chairman, I know there's a number of people on the teleconference who would like to testify.
Okay, I'll get some of those right now. Sister Kay, is it Belch Kay, Michelle, or something from Providence Hospital? I've got a handwritten thing here, and I'm struggling with it.
Yes, it's Sister Kay Belcher.
Belcher. Okay, thank you. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Sister Kay Belcher. I'm the Assistant Administrator for Mission Integration and Community Services with the Providence Health System here in Alaska. On behalf of the Providence Health System, I wish to express our strong support for Senate Joint Resolution 35, which would address an issue recently raised by the state Supreme Court regarding the fourth provision of abortion in the state. The Providence Health System has and will continue to support the right of individuals and organizations to opt out of service that they find objectionable. We certainly respect the beliefs and conscience of others, and while we clearly make known our values, we do not seek to impose our values on others, and nor do we want others to values to be imposed on us. SJR 35 will ensure that this kind of mutual respect will continue to exist with regard to the performance of abortion. The Alaska State Supreme Court decision identified a need for recognition of this mutual respect of choice to be added to the actual language of the state constitution. And without SJR 35, the court found that the state law, which currently allows hospital a freedom of choice, is unconstitutional as applied to quasi-public hospitals. Yet the definition given of quasi-public hospitals is so broad that it could apply to every single hospital in the state of Alaska. I think the court in essence found that without the language of SJR 35 actually being in the Constitution, there could be a giant leap in this state from recognition of a right to choose to be involved in abortion to a mandate to participate in abortion services. We are very grateful that and thankful that Senator Miller has introduced SJR 35 and strongly encourage you to vote for its passage. And this concludes my comments, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. No questions. Robert Flint.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Flint. I'm a local attorney in private practice in Anchorage, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of myself and also authorized to speak on behalf of Archbishop Francis Hurley. In support of Senate Joint Resolution Number 35, which is a preservation of the status quo as it existed for 27 years prior to the adoption of the Supreme Court decision last November. I think the reason, as I say, the language is exactly the same as it was in that statute, simply putting in the Constitution. Reason for the language cannot be put any better than that from Representative Jackson, as was quoted by Senator Miller just a few minutes ago. The theory was that everybody had their choice and no coercion was involved. Valley Hospital case has leaked that boundary, and now coercion is involved. I would suggest four reasons why the Supreme Court decision is erroneous. First, they took, arbitrarily, I believe, took a law proclaiming a right and changed it, as Sister said, into a mandate. There are other, of course, constitutional rights, explicit constitutional rights rather than implicit, as abortion is. There is certainly freedom to the press, freedom of the press. There is no requirement that anyone, including government, fund the press or run off the newspapers. There is freedom of religion, but certainly neither government nor anybody builds churches except those who want to on a voluntary basis. There is freedom of speech, but the government doesn't have to fund a book for somebody or pay the stamp to send the letter to the editor. It is a far jump, in my opinion, to go from a right to a mandate and a coercion on other people. Secondly, I think, again, following up Senator Miller's comments, the court has taken the wrong inference, the wrong extension of the privacy amendment to the Constitution. That was passed, of course, by the legislature, put on the ballot and passed in 1972, only 2 years after the abortion liberalization statute, of which this conscience clause is a part. And, of course, that was a law which achieved a great deal of notoriety. So the public was well aware of the conscience types clause that appeared here. And I think it can be fairly assumed that neither the legislature, as Senator Miller says, nor the public believe that a statute that protects a right was turned around and made into a weapon to coerce people whose profound beliefs prevented them from being involved in such activities. Thirdly, I believe the court has downgraded rights that have been traditionally respected in this country, particularly moral and religious beliefs on the part of people and the institutions these people create when they form together to carry out their actions. I believe that traditionally such beliefs have been infringed only in the strictest and most emergency circumstances. And I believe that the quote from Representative Jackson indicates that that expression of his is the traditional respect for other people's beliefs and the idea that they are forbidden to be coerced into anything else. And finally, I think the court has infringed on the people through the legislature to involve themselves in and decide great decisions. I think in a similar philosophical bent, the recent case on assisted suicide, which was decided by the Ninth Circuit, who found a right to assisted suicide in the United States Constitution, over a dissent by Judge Andrew Kleinfeld from Fairbanks, who commented rather correctly, I think, that the Constitution was not written so the courts could decide all the important issues, and the people and the legislature could decide all the minor ones. As we know, by 9-0, Judge Kleinfeld's view was upheld by the United States Supreme Court. I think we're in a similar circumstance here, and the people, through their legislature, as they did in 1970, have a right and an obligation to sort these matters out. I think Senate Joint Resolution 35 is a mere expression of that, adding nothing beyond that which was expressed in 1970, worked well for 27 years, and should continue to work. Therefore, Archbishop Hurley, of course, and myself would urge and support the passage of Senate Joint Resolution 35. Thank you very much for the opportunity to present my comments.
Thank you. Ken Jacobus.
Thank you, Senator. I represented certain amicus curiae legislators in the Valley Hospital case. This afternoon, I'm making this presentation on my own behalf. I agree with Mr. Flint and the Archbishop on all points. What's happened particularly is that the Supreme Court has turned what was once a right into a weapon. Alaska now, by judicial decision, has the strongest abortion rights in the United States. Additionally, the Alaska Supreme Court also tossed out freedom of religion, along with the freedom of conscience in this case. The Supreme Court specifically stated, nothing said in this opinion should be taken to suggest that a quasi-public hospital could have a policy based on the religious tenets of its sponsors, which could be a compelling state interest. Recognizing such a policy as compelling could violate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. I believe that this particular Senate Joint Resolution should be enacted, that the question should be placed on the ballot. All that it does is balance interests between the two competing sides on this issue. It does not prevent a woman from getting an abortion should she choose to do so. But it also protects the right of the hospital or individual to refuse to participate in the abortion procedure and protects both the freedom of conscience and the religious beliefs of the hospitals and the individuals. It is narrowly addressed to the specific problem which has to be taken care of. It should be placed on the ballot. Thank you.
Thank you. Jennifer, I think it's Ruttinger.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Ruttinger, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Civil Liberties Union. The Alaska Civil Liberties Union is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization with approximately 800 members in the state of Alaska. Our mission is to preserve and defend the guarantees of individual liberty found in the Bill of Rights and in the Alaska Constitution. I've come here today on behalf of our membership to urge you to kill SJR 35 in this committee because it is based on misinformation and an implausible misreading of the Alaska Supreme Court's decision last fall in the Valley Hospital case. Valley Hospital was brought by the Alaska Civil Liberties Union, and if any of you would like to get a copy of the court's decision, I'm happy to provide you with one. You can call my office at area code 907-258 0044, and we'll send it right out to you. In the meantime, I want to take this opportunity to dispel some of the myths floating around about this case. Myth number one, you may have heard it said that hospital staff who oppose abortion will have to participate in abortion procedures. This is absolutely false. There's no mandate here. I'm going to quote here, I want to quote to you from the Superior Court's final judgment in Valley Hospital, which was affirmed in the Supreme Court's decision. The Supreme Court, in affirming this judgment, expressly provided, quote, "Nothing in the permanent injunction granted as part of this final judgment shall require any member of the medical staff of Valley Hospital or any other officer, agent, servant, or employee of Valley Hospital to participate directly in the performance of any abortion procedure if that person, for reasons of conscience or belief, objects to doing so." The ACLU agrees with that, and that's what our Constitution holds already. That's what our Supreme Court has said in Valley Hospital. Myth number two, you may have heard it said that if no employees of Valley Hospital want to perform an abortion, that the hospital would have to then go out and hire additional staff in order to provide abortion. Again, this is not what Valley Hospital says. All the Supreme Court was saying was that the hospital could not have a policy banning abortions if there were doctors on staff who were willing to perform them, given that a woman's right to make the difficult, painful choice of whether to have a lawful abortion is a fundamental right. The court and our Alaska Constitution recognize that reasonable people may disagree with respect to abortion, and they therefore leave it up to each of us as individuals to decide whether and to what extent we will participate in an abortion. That's all that this court and that's all the case was about, was a ban, a flat policy banning abortions at the hospital. That's it. And that's what was ruled unconstitutional. Myth number three, you may have heard that hospitals, after this case, cannot assert a religious basis for restricting abortions. Again, false. Valley Hospital, a non-sectarian hospital built with state funds, did not and could not assert a religious basis for its restrictive abortion policy. Private hospitals, such as Providence, are not covered by this decision and may prohibit abortion. Furthermore, according to the ACLU's cooperating attorney in this case, Steve Williams, according to Valley Hospital, the Supreme Court explicitly left open, whether another quasi-public hospital might assert a religious exemption based on constitutional religious freedom principles to the general constitutional requirement that such hospitals must respect a woman's fundamental rights of privacy, her rights of conscience, belief, and choice with respect to lawful abortion. I hope this information is helpful. There's a lot of myths floating around out there, and please do take the time to read the Valley Hospital opinion, and feel free to contact me if you have any questions. Thank you.
Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'm still a little mystified here. I'm not sure what the what she was trying to get at, because the amendment says nothing in this Constitution requires a hospital or person to participate in the abortion. It doesn't talk about the ability, you know, saying a person can't get an abortion. It just actually it echoes many of those same things that she says she supports, the person not to participate. So I guess I'm a little bit mystified at what their opposition is. If they truly mean that people should have that right not to choose, what is their opposition?
Can you answer that?
Yes, thank you. If I may respond to that, Senator Miller and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the problem with this constitutional amendment is, first of all, in the sense of a person being required to participate in an abortion, that's not the case now. And so putting it in here saying that nothing in this Constitution requires a person to participate is redundant. The court has already said that. And when our objection to the hospital part of the amendment, nothing requires a hospital to participate. When you have a public or quasi-public hospital which gets state funds and which cannot or does not assert a religious basis for restricting abortion, as was the case with Valley Hospital. They did not assert any religious basis for their policy, nor could they. In that situation, this is a fundamental right. The reasonable people disagree. What the hospital cannot, in our opinion and under this case, do is ban abortions if there are doctors and staff who are willing to perform them, any more than a hospital could force a doctor to perform an abortion if that doctor did not want to. The problem here is saying that a hospital, first of all, has a right of privacy, which seems a little odd, and second of all, that a hospital's majority could pass a policy which infringes on individual choice of the doctor or the staff whether or not they want to perform an abortion. We think it's an individual choice, as the Supreme Court has stated. It should be up to the doctor and up to the staff, not the hospital, not a state-funded public hospital.
Maybe, Jennifer, if you could, this is Senator Taylor. I understand your argument. I guess my concern is when a hospital board sits down with their medical staff and attempts to make decisions about various procedures that they either will or will not allow within their facility, and having represented a couple different hospitals over the years, frequently you look at these situations, especially those that are more risky, that are based on potential liabilities. Nothing directly comes to mind, but let's just use as a hypothetical neurosurgery. I don't know that the board of directors in Wrangell General would like to authorize their surgical staff to do neurosurgery. Now, there may be an individual within that medical staff who believes himself to be the hottest rock that ever came into town to do that type of surgery. Are you telling me that because of the Valley Hospital case, that board could not restrict that physician from doing that type of surgery?
No, I'm not, Senator Taylor. What is the difference? What the difference is between Valley Hospital and your hypothetical is that abortion and reproductive choice are fundamental rights under the Constitution of the United States and under the Alaska Constitution. That raises the stakes. That means that a state-funded public or quasi-public hospital has to show a compelling interest in restricting it, unlike neurosurgery or any other procedure.
No, maybe you're missing my analogy. I'm assuming that the patient who comes in with the doctor and wants to have his doctor perform neurosurgery in Wrangell General Hospital is a patient who is almost in extremis, that but for this surgery they're going to die. We're talking about someone that has a serious medical condition and has a right to life. I think right to life, liberty, property, I think it's kind of fundamental. Maybe I'm missing something, that the ACLU places rights of privacy above the right to life, but gosh, I sure hope not.
Well, Mr. Chairman, your analogy also implicates the right to privacy. I mean, these are private medical choices being made by an individual who wants to have neurosurgery by this particular doctor, so I think the same rights are still implicated, and that's why I think your analogy, I'm kind of curious if there's where the distinction is.
That's what I'm looking for. Where is the distinction? If you can find one for us, Jennifer, I'd sure appreciate it.
Sure. In fact, in the Valley Hospital case itself, the Alaska Supreme Court is saying that there is a fundamental right to reproductive choice, that this is a personal, private decision between a woman and her physician in a state-funded hospital. The difference is that there has never been a case saying that neurosurgery is a fundamental right, and we haven't needed to because there aren't the moral implications and the questions that go along with neurosurgery that there are in a situation with abortion. Again, the ACLU isn't saying and would never say that an individual who had a conscientious objection to performing an abortion should be forced to do so, and they're not, and they cannot legally be forced to do so under Valley Hospital. The court explicitly says that. What we're saying is that a hospital itself, certain state-funded hospitals covered by this case, in the situation of restricting fundamental rights, the hospital cannot pass a flat ban telling doctors who want to perform abortions, no, you may not, nor can the hospital insist that doctors who do not want to perform abortions must perform them. We're saying these are all individual choices to be made by the doctors and the staff, and that's what the Supreme Court says in Valley Hospital.
Yeah, I guess you still haven't answered my question about doctors exercising unlimited individual choices in the types of procedures they may carry out. I think that does significantly invade the authority and the obligation of the Board of Trustees of a hospital to make certain and protect the hospital. I don't think you're indicating that we should allow incompetent physicians to do things, and I'm certainly not taking it that way. But let me ask you one other question. You said that this case was very narrow and that it was only limited to those circumstances found at Valley Hospital, where that was a hospital built with state or municipal funds or borough funds. And I guess my concern is, tell me what happens to Ketchikan General Hospital, which was built by state and municipal and some federal funding, and it's been run by the Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace under a contract with the city of Ketchikan for 40-some years, maybe 50 years now. What happens down there?
Well, you know, the court leaves that open. All I can do is tell you what the Valley Hospital, what the Supreme Court has said. In the Valley Hospital decision, the court explicitly notes that Valley Hospital had no religious affiliation and was not run by any religious organization, and that was part of the basis of their decision. They left open whether another quasi-public hospital might assert a religious exemption. That wasn't the question presented to them, and so that wasn't anything that was decided. It is very clear that a private hospital such as Providence is not covered. They obviously can assert a religious exemption, and so they can prohibit abortions.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Miller?
Thank you. Well, that brings up an interesting question, Mr. Chairman. Let's take an individual decides that they, and I'm not sure what the practice is at the Ketchikan Hospital, but I would assume that they probably do not offer abortions there. What happens if an individual decides they do want one there and they file a lawsuit against Ketchikan General? Where will the ACLU fall out on this issue? I mean, you brought suit on this first one, or you helped certainly in the suit. Where would you be in a certain lawsuit like that? You said, you know, the court didn't answer that question. I expect that will be one of the next lawsuits filed.
Your question, Senator Miller, involves a quasi-public hospital that I have to confess I don't know a lot about the hospital in Ketchikan that you're talking about. A quasi-public hospital that does have a religious affiliation, is that what you're asking?
From my understanding, that would be the situation of the hospital in Ketchikan, yes.
Okay, well, I would have to, I don't want to speak for my board on that. That question hasn't been presented to us, and I'd like to reserve judgment, talk to some of our attorneys, and get back with you, if I may.
Certainly. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jennifer. We took a little longer there with you than we had with the others, but I do appreciate your answers. I still have out on the teleconference in Delta Junction, Ms. Deborah Jocelyn.
Hi, I'm Deborah Jocelyn. I just wanted to give my support for Senate Joint Resolution Number 35. I believe that any hospital has a right to establish their own policies. Regardless of what their staff thinks about, if their staff doesn't like that, they can leave and find employment elsewhere. The people in charge of the hospital have a right to make their own policies regarding abortion and a number of other things. It's the hospital that would be liable if anything went wrong in an abortion. The only thing I would question about this SJR 35 is, I'm wondering, Senator, if House Joint Resolution Number 5 doesn't cover this better, because it's the freedom of conscience. and it goes a little bit farther, and it almost feels like SJR 35 is a Band-Aid, and it's the same question is going to come up in different forms again. And I would say, like, assisted suicide, if we cover this with just this resolution, then is the ACLU going to come back again and say that in a few years that the hospital has to provide assisted suicide to patients? And also situations like my husband and I have considered opening a daycare center, a Christian daycare center, where children would be taught the Bible, we would pray before we ate, and we would do all of that with permission from their parents. They would have a sign thing, and they would know ahead of time, so it would be okay with their parents. My question is, would it be okay with the ACLU? Would we have to hire a Buddhist? Would we have to hire atheists? Or could we open such a daycare center and not get in trouble if we only wanted to hire Christians? And so for that, I'm wondering if maybe we wouldn't be better to go with House Joint Resolution number 5.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was looked at. Of course, House Joint Resolution number 5 is working its way through the House, and we decided to offer this just to deal with the Pacific Valley Hospital there and the ruling that came down in the court, although I'll be very interesting to see what happens with House Joint Resolution number 5 as it works its way through the House side.
Okay, thank you very much. Rebecca Braun, or it looks like B-R-A-U-N. I haven't lost track of you, Cliff, out there in Mat-Su, and I'll get to you next.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Braun, and I live in Juneau. I'm here to testify on behalf of the Juneau Coalition for Pro-Choice. The Juneau Coalition for Pro-Choice wishes to go on record opposing SJR 35, which seeks to amend Alaska's constitution to give hospital boards the right to restrict access to abortion services. The proposed amendment is apparently a response to a recent Alaska Supreme Court case, Valley Hospital Association versus Mat-Su Coalition for Choice, which stated that a quasi-public or public hospital could not unconstitutionally deny a woman access to abortion services. The Alaska Supreme Court recognized that a woman's right to make reproductive choices for herself with the assistance of her health care practitioner is protected under the Alaska Constitution. A public or quasi-public hospital board comprised of lay citizens charged with overseeing the fiscal health of the hospital cannot restrict that constitutional right for reasons that have nothing to do with medical practice. This resolution would change that. It would, in effect, allow a handful of people to make reproductive choices for their entire community. We do not believe hospital board members should be making decisions based on their personal value systems that will limit the medical options of thousands of women. A quasi-public or public hospital does not belong to the board of directors. It belongs to the community, to the patients who use it, to the people seeking medical assistance. For a group of non-medical citizens to overrule the decisions of a woman and her doctor is disrespectful both to women and to healthcare professionals. The sponsors of SJR 35 would have us believe that they are trying to protect the rights of hospital personnel to act in accordance with their personal belief systems. We agree that individual hospital staff should not be forced to participate in abortion procedures against their will. But I'd like to repeat what Jennifer of the Civil Liberties Union said. There is nothing in the VHA decision which would compel individuals to assist in abortions against their will. Instead, the sponsors of this bill are actually attempting to get around a Supreme Court decision they do not like. The Alaska Constitution was carefully crafted to protect the rights and freedoms of all Alaskans. We are fearful of a legislature that takes the Constitution so lightly and seems willing to rewrite it when its provisions do not suit their agendas. I believe this act will outrage the pro-choice majority in Alaska, as well as all Alaskans who value their liberty. On behalf of the Juneau Coalition for Pro-Choice and the pro-choice community in Alaska, I urge you not to pass SJR 35 out of committee. Thank you for your time.
Questions? Thank you.
Could I actually add one more thing?
Go right ahead. You've waited a long time. You've got every right to talk.
Okay, thanks. I know that you maybe were a little dissatisfied with Jennifer's response to your neurosurgery in Wrangell analogy.
No, I just don't understand it yet.
Okay, well, I think that I think that you want to know the difference. You know, what if somebody stood up and wrangled a doctor and said, I want to perform neurosurgery, and a woman or man or whoever said, yeah, I want this person to perform neurosurgery on me. Well, I think the difference is that we're not saying people who are unqualified to perform abortions should be able to perform abortions. That we're saying that you're saying somebody who's not qualified to perform neurosurgery shouldn't perform neurosurgery, which I agree.
No, I'm not. I'm just saying that maybe this person is a terrific neurosurgeon. That board and that hospital decide that that's kind of a risky surgery and the kind of thing that they don't want their hospital participating in. And I know for a fact hospital boards and medical staffs make this decision every day all across the state. And they do it based upon, do we want physicians in our hospitals doing certain on the cutting edge of medical practice kind of stuff? And the bigger hospitals kind of do that, and the smaller hospitals get a little more conservative, and you get further out, you become very conservative about what you're going to let your staff do or not do. Based on the choice, the freedom of choice of that board of trustees who's attempting to exercise it on behalf of their community. I don't think there are religious implications one way or another. I don't think there are moral implications one way or another. It's a decision about should they be allowed to still continue to do that.
Right, and therein lies the difference, I think. Well,
The difference is, in this instance, we've got a qualified doctor. He's got a patient. Patient's life's hanging in the balance, and that doctor says, I don't care what you say on the board. I'm going to do this.
Well, may I just respond what I think the difference is? I believe the difference is that in one case, the board wants to limit what its doctors can do for the safety of, you know, they're fearful for the safety, saying we're too small a hospital, this is too risky. And that they certainly have a right to do. That's for medical reasons. But I stated that I don't believe that a board should be able to restrict women's medical options for non-medical reasons, for reasons of their religious beliefs.
I know what you're saying, that they should not exercise their religious beliefs in that board. I understand that argument. I think the analogy is a little different than that, but that's where the rub kind of comes, isn't it? I can remember the ACLU strongly fighting for and advocating for the right of George Lincoln Rockwell and the Nazi Party to march down the streets of Skokie, Illinois. And I mean, it takes some courage to stand up for various rights, but it really becomes difficult sometimes to understand how the motivation can be so strong to stand up for one group's rights in one side of the argument at the same time disregard the right of choice on the part of the other participants.
Well, I think maybe you're still not understanding that no individual would be compelled to perform an abortion. Who doesn't believe that is more
than compelled to clean up the room afterwards?
Well,
is the janitor going to be compelled? You know, is the receptionist going to be compelled? Is the bookkeeper going to be compelled?
Right. I don't know yet what the legal decision is.
Well, I think it's important, don't you?
It is important. It would be an important question to ask. You know?
I mean, we're all dancing around with, oh, gee, the actual person who performs it, we'd never put a gun to their head and make them go in and do this, but what about all the other chain of people that are involved in the process? If I go into a hospital to have some minor surgery done, it seems like I've got to go through about 30 different people and fill out 100 different pieces of paper, and then I get bills and stuff from different folks and emphasis. And, you know, fortunately the janitorial staff haven't started doing their own billing system yet, but you almost feel like that at some point in time. In other words, where does the chain end, I guess, is part of our concern.
Yeah, I'm curious about that as well. And one other thing, some people were, for example, at Bartlett Hospital in Juneau, which certainly qualifies as public or quasi-public, there are no abortions performed. There also are not abortions performed in Ketchikan, for those who are wondering. as far as I know, Valley Hospital was it wasn't. But there are none in Southeast. And it's just that, so that's within Bartlett's legal right that they don't offer abortions, but they don't have a policy expressly forbidding abortions. And I believe that's the difference.
On that,
Providence Hospital is an example in Anchorage. Nonprofit, but they receive millions of dollars in Medicaid funds. Is that a quasi-public hospital? I mean, do you know what is a quasi-public?
You know, I'm not an expert in this one either, but those are federal funds, so I assume that's sort of...
Are they receiving lots of state funds?
Lots of state funds.
Yeah. Medicare is federal.
Yeah. I don't know.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, through the chairman, actually, I have the court decision here, and I think actually Providence fits at least two of the three criteria, and maybe the third criteria they set out.
What's the criteria?
First criteria is that you participate in the Certificate of Deed program. Certainly, Providence participates in the Certificate of Deed program. The one that I'm not sure about is that you receive construction funds, lands, or operating funds from state and local government. Now, I'm not sure when Providence moved from their location in downtown Anchorage to where they are currently at, how that was necessarily funded and what land that they used, but, so that's a question mark. I don't know.
My question is whether Medicaid would be operating.
And the third criteria is a portion of the operating funds are received from government sources. And earlier on, they go back to the stores versus the whole Lutheran hospitals, and I believe that is 25% of the funds from the hospitals come from government sources, and I'm sure Providence is well over 25% of their total funds. So they easily meet two of the three requirements, and they may meet the third requirement for a quasi-public corporation.
Anything further?
Nothing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Clifton Orm, out in Metsu.
Yes, this is Cliff Orm, and I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Valley Hospital Association. I'd like to speak in support of SGR 35. There are advantages to going to testifying at the end because I would like to address some of the comments that have been made. I'd like to first quote from a letter to association members outlining Valley Hospital's position. Also, quote from a resolution that the board intends to put forth and address some of the specific comments of the ACLU representative and also the Juno Coalition for Pro-Choice representative. First of all, our board issued the following statement about to its association members. It says, over the last 2 months, Valley Hospital Association has concluded its 5-year struggle to defend its conscience-protecting policy against having to offer elective abortions. On Friday, November 21, 1997, the Alaska Supreme Court struck down the Alaska Conscience Clause, upon which VHA had relied in formulating its conscience-protecting policy as it applied to VHA. This state statute expressly provided that no hospital in Alaska could be required to offer abortions and that no person could be required to participate in them. The Alaska Supreme Court determined that both the Alaska Conscience Clause and the hospital's conscience-protecting policy violated the right to privacy provision of the Alaska Constitution. The court found that the state constitution contained an affirmative right to abortion, which is much more expansive than the federal right to abortion. In Roe versus Wade, the United States Supreme Court held that the right to privacy in the federal constitution contained a negative right to abortion, which merely meant that a state could not outlaw the performance of abortions, not that the hospitals had to provide them. We regret that its defense of conscience protecting policy was unsuccessful. We are making every effort to comply with the state's permanent injunctions while at the same time protecting the conscientious beliefs of all our employees. That's from a letter from the operating board of directors to the association members. Tonight the board will meet, and we're going to consider a resolution, which I believe very strongly will be voted and supported by our board in support of Senate Joint Resolution 35, proposing amendment to our Constitution relating to participating in an abortion. I'd like to address a couple of the comments made from Jennifer Ruttinger from the ACLU regarding myths. Myth number one, employees don't have to participate if they don't wish to. I believe that that statement is misinformed or a misinformed position. As Senator Taylor Mr. Chairman, you spoke about indirect versus direct participation in abortion. There are many people in the hospital, including those who answer the phone, those who have to clean up, those who are involved in any way, billing, transcribing for those services, who are opposed to participating. Now, we do not have to offer them the right to refuse. We are allowing them that right, but it poses staffing problems because, let's say, no one wants to participate or be involved indirectly. We would have to find employees who would agree to perform, whether direct perform that service, whether directly or indirectly. That is the second myth that she discussed. Hospital doesn't have to find employees to perform abortions if none are available. The third myth she talked about was that private or religious hospitals don't have to offer abortion services. Our understanding of the court ruling was that it applies to all facilities. If they receive state funding or federal funding, any kind of government funding. And so in each one of these cases, on all of these myths that she brought up, our legal counsel has advised us that what she is saying is incorrect. Lastly, I'd like to speak to a comment that Rebecca Braun from the Juno Coalition for Pro-Choice made about the board not being representative of the community. Our community board is set up as in a cooperative format, much like a co-op. And so members of our borough can elect or do elect an association board who in turn elects an operating board. So there is community participation in the selection of the policymakers or the governance structure of the organization. These board members do not act in a vacuum. They are representing the voice of the people. And so in conclusion, I would just like to say that we are in support of Senate Joint Resolution 35. We believe that it will be good to have the people of the state of Alaska have the right and opportunity to make this decision rather than the court. Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to check, see if there was anybody online in Ketchikan. Our system of shipping stuff back and forth for information isn't working real good today, and we're kind of doing it all handwritten on little notes and pieces of paper here. So if I've missed anybody down there, I didn't mean to. Do you have anybody in Ketchikan? If I don't hear anything, I'll assume there's no one there. Was there anyone else in the room that wished to participate or testify? Was there anybody else online that I've missed out there? I had Anchorage, Delta Junction, Matsu, and Ketchikan. Okay. Pleasure with the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cornell.
The only question I had, and it goes back to something Senator Miller said about the court decision. I question the word hospital in the amendment and whether that is too limiting in the sense that there are other health care facilities that receive funding from the state, and I just wondered if Senator Miller could address why the word hospital was used, if in that three-part test the court specifically referred to a hospital, or whether they said basically made it refer to any health care facility, in terms of what's right. Quasi-public.
There may be somebody online that could better answer that question, because I did ask that same question, and it was, from my understanding, I may have misinterpreted, because other types of facilities would either be partnerships or something, or corporations, which would fall under the person definition. But I could be wrong, but I think either Mr. Jacobus or Mr. Flint could answer that question better than I could, because that was a question that I asked, and they had come back that this would cover everybody out there. So if they're still online, maybe they could answer that question a little better than I did.
Mr. Flint, are you still online?
Mr. Chairman, I am. Thank you. The reason, obviously, pretty clearly, the word hospital is in there was because it was in the statute, and that was exactly what was presented and at issue with the case. I do not, Mr. Jacobus might help me, I don't, because he was actively involved in the case, whether that word is limiting or they made it broader to apply to clinics, I'm just not sure, so I refer to him.
I don't know that was discussed in the case either. If we want to protect the rights of a healthcare facility, to participate in abortion, we should broaden the language of Senate Joint Resolution number 35. Take the word hospital out and put healthcare facility in.
That'd be fine. Yeah. As I say, the only reason the hospital was put in there was that was the way the statute was originally written. That was the only reason.
It may be unreasonably limited because I don't think necessarily clinics would fall within the definition of the word person. So clinics may be left out of the protections that Senate Joint Resolution number 35 desires to provide. Well, I think my reaction would be to change the word hospital to healthcare facility to make sure we cover all the way from hospitals on down.
Jennifer, are you still out there? Did you have comments?
Other than that, we would oppose that. Not in terms of how a hospital's defined or anything. I don't have a comment on that.
Okay, I wanted to give you a chance to speak on it, too. I'd like to hear from both sides of these things as we
move on. Yeah, I don't have a basis at this time for commenting on the definition of hospital or how the courts interpret that. I don't know.
Well, I think that it is probably something that Senator Parnell, I know, and I have concerns about the definitional effect of these words. We sometimes throw them around somewhat loosely, but they do have significant impact out there. And Senator Parnell?
Well, just from the decision itself, the decision was limited. The question was, in order to determine whether the hospital operated by VHA is a quasi-public institution, we looked at a number of factors, and then they went through the factors that Senator Miller stated. So probably besides being in statute as hospital, it was limited to the word hospital because that's specifically what the court decision addressed. And then the question is, will future courts limit it only to hospitals, or will they make the same analysis with respect to other healthcare facilities that receive public funds? And it's worth discussion, I think.
Yes. Yes, Senator Pierce.
Thank you. I have a question for the ACLU, Mr. Chairman.
Jennifer, can you hear her?
I can.
Good.
In our statutes, under living wills and do not resuscitate orders, Chapter 12 of Title 18, under Section 1812.050, transfer of patients, the statute calls for if an attending physician is unwilling to comply with the requirements, which require that if a person has declared or if the family has declared the life-sustaining procedures will be withheld or withdrawn, that the physician has to do so, has to comply, or pull out as the attending physician. Then it goes further to say if the policy of the healthcare facility preclude compliance, so on and so forth, that the facility shall take all reasonable steps to explain to the patient or the family that their policy is that they do not comply, and then they're supposed to take reasonable steps to transfer the patient to a facility that does apply. Did the ACLU support in 1994 the do not resuscitate living wills and do not resuscitate order amendments that put this into place?
Thank you, Senator Pierce. I would have to get back with you on that because I just started this job last spring. So I don't know whether we took a position in 94 or what it was. I will, however, find out and get back with you this